regulated activities. Preliminary analysis of asset and liability.
Thanks, Hans. Good morning, everybody. We're here today to look at Agenda Paper 9, which is Hans Davies, our preliminary analysis of the assets and liability definitions in the context of our continuing discussions of the distinguishing features of rate regulation to help us to develop a discussion paper to issue sometime in 2014. In October's meeting, we looked at the distinguishing features and the rights and obligations arising from those features, and agreed that for the purposes of progressing the project, we were going to focus in particular on one feature, which was the rate setting mechanism and the rights and obligations that allowed a true-up adjustment to arise that entities could then apply to their future rates. And the purpose of this paper, therefore, is to take that particular feature and analyse it against the definitions of assets and liabilities in the existing conceptual framework and also in the conceptual framework discussion paper. And as we note in paragraph 19 of this paper, we don't have any detailed questions. The purpose of this discussion is really to take your initial views and comments as to the direction that the analysis is taking, any ideas you might have to progress this project going forward, whether you think we're on the right track or not, and any suggestions as to what type of asset or liability if you agree with the staff's preliminary view that we might actually get to would be gratefully received. Before we start off the discussion though, I think it's important to mention that last Friday we had a meeting with our consultative group for the Rate Regulated Activities Project, and at that meeting one of the topics that we discussed was the board paper from October, where we did look at the rights and obligations of those common features. A couple of main messages that I picked up from that particular discussion. One is that the description of the dual element adjustment mechanism that's contained in this paper this month perhaps isn't quite refined enough. It doesn't quite capture what I think some of the consultative group members think it should capture. I think particularly the terminology maybe needs refining just to clarify these issues. The second main message is that quite a few members of the consultative group think perhaps that we're too narrowly focused by picking on this particular feature, and many of them felt that we should go back wider to look at the general features, and some of them thought that the fact that they have a monopoly and there is a regulatory framework, a legal framework that they can look to for the adjustment should be sufficient. However, I think for the purposes of the discussion this morning, I would ask you, if you're willing, to focus on the description of the dual element adjustment that we do have in this paper. We know it's not perfect, but I think for the purpose of progressing the conversation, it's probably reasonably adequate, but obviously if people have got questions that they would like clarifications, then I'm happy to deal with those. And also in terms of whether we blow the discussion back out to the other features, again, I think for the purposes of just moving forward on this project, I think it would be helpful to keep the focus quite narrow for today's project, and then we can come back in the new year with another paper that goes back wider again, depending on the outcome of this conversation today. So with that, I can see that a few people are ready to jump in with questions and comments, and that's absolutely fine, so I'll open up the floor at this point.
As you said, some members, well, at least one called me, member of the group called me and expressed some concerns that the focus was a bit too narrow, but I'm quite happy to discuss today on a narrow focus, but that should not prejudice maybe the next discussion that you propose to have on a slightly wider focus. So it's fine, but maybe not draw conclusions today. I think we should keep the discussion, especially for a discussion paper, relatively open and not exclude forever one possible wider scope.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd agree totally with that.
The basis of your conclusions really is that this is a practical and reliable mechanism to make the true up, and so on that basis. And I'm just trying to understand how it works, and I want to keep it really simple. So if you've got, you sell 100 units at 10, so you make 1,000, for whatever reason you decide there's a 500 true up for the next year.
Yeah.
So you put the price up to 15 on the basis you're going to sell 100 at 15, so you'll make 1,500. What happens if you sell 200? You know, the change in demand, do you then give it back? You know, you're trying to collect an extra 500, you're going to collect an extra 1,000 because of the increase in sales. What happens next?
The mechanism is that the following year or the following regulatory period, you're forced to bring the price back down again to give back the additional 500 that you've over-collected.
You might end up with a liability at the end of the reporting period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a continual sort of moving target.
Exactly.
Really, because you can't predict demand.
That's why these liabilities come into existence.
Exactly. I mean, the number can be positive or negative depending on
the. You never
on
know exactly the volume that you will achieve.
Yeah.
And then to me, then the big question is the control question. You know, do you control that asset or liability? And that's the one I had difficulty answering.
Mary?
Ian gave me the perfect TF because, like him, I share. I have significant concerns about the conclusion that there's an asset that you control as a result of the rate regulation mechanism. Let me be clear. I think there's a question that I really want to explore in the discussion paper and consultation about the relevance of information about rate regulation and its impact. And I think that personally, I may conclude that it's so relevant that this information should be captured through a recognition and measurement approach. But I did not see in this paper the staff explaining why the high probability that you will capture that the mechanism will give you increases when you're trying to capture a shortfall in the current period creates a right that meets the definition of an asset under either our current framework or the modified definition that we explore in the discussion paper, because I'm with you in terms of the mechanisms, in terms of the focus on the dual rate to begin with, but then I get to that point and it just seems like it says because we say so, and I was contrasting this with a situation in which you don't have rate regulation, and this is a hypothetical. If you have an unlimited ability, i.e. not subject to regulation, if you have an unlimited ability to increase your price, it doesn't give you an asset. Why is it that when you put in a mechanism that restricts your ability to change your price, that the insertion of that mechanism creates something that meets the definition of a right under the conceptual framework? And I'm focusing on the asset side rather than the liability side, because at least in the context of the current revenue recognition standards, I think there's an issue of, in Ian's example, if you over-collected because the volume was different than what you expected, about whether or not you have earned that, satisfied the recognition criteria for that revenue. So my negativity about this is about some of the analysis and how we've looked at the definition of an asset. It is not rejecting the notion of the relevance of this information and relevance that may well go be so great that it demands a response that's other than disclosure.
Martin.
Yeah. And when I read this paper, I think I could follow the argument, which then you could conclude maybe it isn't liability or an asset, but I thought some of the arguments you restrictly because you're saying, okay, it is a monopoly and the customer has no choice, and I thought myself, from the country where I'm coming from, that is already not the case, because that is a the market of energy or whatever, there is competition. Maybe there are only four or five companies, but this kind of what you're describing here and your argumentation on monopoly and the customer has not any choice, I think is not really what in Europe is going on. Because there is a lot of competition coming into the market, and there is this question. You can really choose between different companies for this essential good, if it is electricity or gas or whatever. You have a choice. And I think, as I said, I could conclude with the argumentation, but that a lot of that was restricted and said, okay, because it is a monopoly and the customer has not any choice. And I think
so. It could never.
It is not
the German market.
It is not the current situation.
I think
the thing is distribution. The transmission, the generation may be the monopoly, but the distribution may be where you have the choice, and that wouldn't necessarily.
I think perhaps it's worth clarifying. We've discussed it before, but probably worth bringing back at this stage. When we're looking at these features, and I think that's why, for the purpose of the asset and liability definition, I think it's useful to narrow the focus on this true-up mechanism. But I think there are other things that we have to have in play to support the analysis, and that's absolutely one of them. And there are some situations, and I know the situation in Europe because of Europe-wide legislation or EU-wide legislation, that's trying to encourage more competition within the energy market. And what's happening in those situations is that the actual distribution chain, as Pat said, is being broken down, in that historically it was often one company that would do the generation and the transmission and the distribution to the individual customers, and the whole process, the whole stream was regulated. What's happening now is that there are aspects of that are broken down, and certainly in Europe there's regulation in place or legislation in place to try and break out the generation phase from the transmission, from the distribution. And even at the generation space, there's increasing competition because more people are allowed to build power stations or wind farms, etc. At the distribution stage, certainly there is more competition. And in the UK, there's at least 8 major companies that supply to the individual customers. The regulation at those more competitive ends is changing. And in some of them, they are becoming almost deregulated because the government is allowing the competition to moderate the price. And there's enough players in the market that if one of them goes bust, one of them has to leave, it goes into liquidation, others can take over the supply of that capacity. And what's been left in some jurisdictions is it's the transmission that's the most heavily regulated. And I think, you know, we need to focus on it's the regulated bits that are not subject to the competition that we're trying to capture here. We're trying to focus on.
Yeah, but, and again, my point is, okay, that our augmentation is though related to if it is a one supplier, monopoly, and the customer has not any choice. But for a discussion paper, I think we maybe have to make it a little bit more open, because otherwise people will think, okay, we are only concentrate on this situation, and from the starting of this project they are excluded from that, and that is a little bit of fear that I have.
Yeah, I take your point, Martin, but yes.
In your case, even though there is competition in your market, there is a kind of a true-up mechanism there in Germany? No.
There's an incentive-based
thing.
And I'm not an expert in how to process.
But there are still some, and again, even in the regulated and the more heavily regulated, it doesn't mean that all of the costs and all of the revenues are regulated. There are certain elements that would be captured by a true-up mechanism, others the company just suffers any variation.
Gary?
I mean, I like to focus this paper, sort of keeping the subject narrow, recognizing there's others. But as I read through this, is a lot of the dialogue and the thinking is, if you're in a rate-regulated entity, looking at it the way the rate regulators look at it, true up, you know, another way to look at it, maybe your resource group looked at it this way, that this is essentially true up of estimates. In the past, because all revenue or all expenses are just literally that, estimates, and you know, for whatever reason, you got to look back through what mechanism to them just refining estimates. Did you, was that considered or discussed in place? And this is really more of an estimation process.
Yeah, I think it was touched on, and certainly that's one of the motivations behind the way that the paper is written, is that it is very much the price is set based on estimates, and it's estimates of costs, estimates of volumes of revenues, etc. But because the regulator has got to try and do this balance between, yes, setting a fair price for consumers and making sure consumers can cope with the price in the market, there's another aspect that the regulator has really got to focus on, which I think is very different from the general market players, in that the regulator has to make sure these companies survive and has to make sure there is some way that they can not only recover their costs, but make sure that they can generate sufficient returns that they can cope with the additional demand that's coming through. Because the regulation says that they have to provide these goods and services on a non-discriminatory basis. And if populations are increasing, these companies have to have the ability to increase the network and increase the availability of supply to cope with the demand, because the regulation says they have to provide these services to people. So I think it's that balancing act that makes this true-up mechanism so important, because if the estimates are too far out, either the customers will suffer, which goes against one of the objectives, or the company is going to suffer, which goes against the other objective, and both of them are important.
Well, because you've got, you know, certain things that will give you the true-up adjustment for. If you're just generally inefficient, you're not likely to get
not caught by this true up.
This is not likely to help you unless you're a very friendly rate regulator.
Yeah.
And the other thing that sort of strikes me in these things is it's a bit of a stretch, but there are some analogies to deferred taxes where you've got two regimes, a GAAP or accounting regime and a regulatory regime that work at different speeds and paces, and these are, you know, the link, the reconciliation, if you will, between them.
That's
I wouldn't necessarily suggest we go that way in this project, but there are some, strikes me as there are some analogies.
But there are quite a lot of people that raise the deferred tax analogy in these conversations.
You only have to look at the current situation in the UK to know that energy prices can be extremely political.
Yes.
And I'm sure that many of these rate regulated entities also operate in a political environment. And doesn't it happen very much that even if you have built up these deferral accounts, that for political reasons, prices are set in such a way that you cannot basically cash in on those deferred assets? And aren't there a lot of readjustments going on? I mean, so how firm would these assets or liabilities be?
I mean, I think it will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but in a lot of them, the regulation is enforceable by law, and there are court cases where energy companies have taken the regulator to court because the regulator is trying to restrict the adjustments that have been built into the regulation. So, again, I think that's analogous in a way to a tax system, except perhaps even stronger, because they can go to court. And you're quite right about the play with the politics, in that there are some situations where the government knows that the consumers won't cope with a massive increase in the rate, or the government don't want to ask the consumers to cope with a massive increase in the rate because it looks bad on the government. And what often happens there is the government use other measures to try and make sure that the company does get the funding that it needs to be able to meet its obligations. And it could well be that the government just changes the tax regime, and instead of collecting money from members of the public through the electricity price or whatever it is, they'll keep the electricity price low but change personal tax and gather it through there, or they'll change corporate tax and gather funds through there, or give the company relief. Occasionally you might get a case where the government agrees to subsidise the company because they know that the customers can't actually cope with such a price hike. There's lots of different mechanisms that come into play to balance the requirements to protect the consumers and protect the company at the same time. And it does get super complex.
Thank you.
Patricia?
I'm quite persuaded by the arguments put forth in the paper that there's a case to be made that they meet the conceptual framework definition of assets, and particularly liabilities under the second alternative in the DP. But listening to the conversation, it suddenly dawned on me that another way we might want to think about this is applying the new revenue recognition standard by analogy, perhaps, and saying what I was thinking is that the contract, because revenue standard is accounting for the contract, that the contract is between the regulated entity and the regulator. And what this mechanism is trying to do is, someone was saying, I think it was Gary, that they've come to an agreement that the regulated entity is going to make X, and then everything else is adjusting to get to X. And so it's to get the revenue recognized when performance occurs is what these adjustments are for.
Yeah.
So we might think about looking at what we can glean from our new revenue standard and application to these scenarios as well.
I've been trying to keep an eye on the revenue project to make sure that what we're thinking of is not clashing with stuff that's in there. We haven't specifically drawn it out in any of these because, as you rightly say, the contract that would be captured by the revenue standard is the contract between the entity and the individual, which is a very, very different relationship between the entity and the regulation. But there's lots of commonalities. You know, lots of people would say it's legally enforceable, so it's not a specific contract, although sometimes it's in the license, so there is that type of contract there. So, yes, we'll consider that as well, bring that in.
Regal?
It is obvious, you know, regulations, regulatory decisions have impact. We should not deny. The question is whether such impact should be recognized or not, or be disclosed or not. If recognized as what? You know,
NBSS or others. I think I agree with Mary, you know. This is the key, you know. Impact, negative, positive, is obvious, you know, but whether we should recognize. And I just touch about the customer basis and control. One of the reasons why original ICSN is, you know, in addition to flexible the mechanism, and one of the important features of regulatory decision nowadays is, to large extent, is not one by one direct, you know, decision. And the regulators will collect different kind of submissions and make decisions, you know, by some way. And we once had a paper provided by the staff several years ago. A small company, within 1 year, submit 30, 40 submissions, you know, say, I want to increase for this transaction, I want decrease for this, you know, casualty. And at the end, regulators will make decisions. That's an aggregate impact, rather than individual impact. And on top of that, there is time lag. You know, you submit a series of submissions within 1 or 2 years, and then 30 years later, the regulator make decision. It's not so clear cut, you know, like, you know, these items were related to such years. And even on top of that, I fully agree with Hans, you know, a lot of, you know, regulatory decision on pricing, to some extent, the politicized. And I discussed with Chung Wu, and recently in Korea, there is a very clear case, you know, and is purely criticizing the relation, you know, even the election of new or old, the present election. And then, if that's the case, you know, as accountant, how we should account for, you know, this is a big issue.
I mean, I think that is an issue that we do need to address in the discussion paper, but it's why I was trying to sort of keep focus narrowly, because those are issues that, you know, if we try and deal with everything at the same time, I don't think we'll progress very far, because there are so many variables and so many implications. So I was trying to keep this as a relatively simple case where there are legally enforceable rights and obligations built in. The true-up adjustment is clearly stated within the regulation, and so it would be clear whether the entity has the ability or the right or the obligation to recognise this true-up adjustment for regulatory purposes. And then the other issues then, it touches on recognition, it touches on measurement. And what I'm trying to do in this paper is focus on the existence of an asset or a liability, and we can pull in the possibility that the regulation might change in the future. But you know, those are future events. And one of the things that I think has influenced this paper quite heavily is in the conceptual framework discussion paper, there is this attempt to try and distinguish between existence and outcome. And that's why, going back to Mary's original point, on a personal basis, I feel more comfortable that we can get to a definition of an asset and a liability, because the probability of the cash flows I'm trying to look at as a separate issue, rather than, and so first of all, trying to get at, do we have rights and obligations that are enforceable? If so, then the probability that the cash flows will follow is a second question. But at the moment, I'm trying to get through the first question, which is, do we have existence?
Changwu?
Thank you. Yeah, I would like to suggest, you know, having more analysis on maybe competition effect. Rather than ignoring such good effect, we should go to attack, challenge such a major, maybe complaint or suggestion. So, yeah, the reason I'm saying is in your, you know, very good paper in paragraph 32D, you listed one of many items that can be true of. Adjustment is that's a financial bonuses and penalties. So we just talked about the incentive-based mechanism in Europe, in Germany.
Yeah.
So if we include such items, you know, bonuses, penalties, then you are saying, you know, even though there is competition, if there is a true mechanism, there is quite, we can expect future benefits or obligations to benefit, then they will be included in this in your scope, right? So anyway, that's not clear whether, you know, that's you know, you are considering that competitive market. So I would like to suggest that directly and analyze such kind of situation more clearly, so our constituents will be more happy to see our analysis.
Yeah, good point.
I just want to say, so Chungwu, is your point that 12D could exist in the presence of competition as well?
Yes.
Yeah. I think, all, to be fair, all of these could exist even in the presence of competition. If there's limited competition, some of these items would still be part of a regulatory regime. The more competition there is, the less these features would come into play.
We can adjust the measurement stage rather than recognition stage, like political influence. If there is a political influence,
yeah,
but there exists the obligation asset, right? But if we adjust the measurement as a new TP on conceptual framework, then we can solve the problem, all the problems.
Jane's response to Wegrow's observations, I guess, sums up really what I had to say. Like Patricia,
I thought you developed a very cogent argument here for why the true-up adjustment represents effectively a right that we could recognize under either the existing or the proposed conceptual framework. As you said, we can get to the issues around the mechanism, and I think the mechanism for collecting cash flows has oftentimes been confused as the asset or the liability, if you will. But I don't think we focused enough on the actual rights that these regulated entities have. And I don't think, as long as we can demonstrate that, I don't think there should be any argument that an asset exists. It may come down to measurement, which is, I think, where Chung was raising some good points. The other point I was going to say here in terms of in response to Weiguo, that you have a footnote here on the bottom of page 11, which I think addresses one of his concerns, and that is the reason why I think you would want to recognize these rights and obligations is if under the framework it's providing relevant information, right? And obviously the probability of recovering or delivering cash flows is going to be critical to how relevant, you know, you ultimately conclude this information is. So I think that's something that we will, as you say, we'll have to further analyze in terms of the context of recognition and measurement criteria. But in my mind, if these are significant aspects of the cash flows of these entities, it would make more sense to recognize them than it would be just to disclose them. So, and then we can get down to the issue of measurement. They may end up in many cases to be quite small. In other cases, it could be quite large. And competition over time may affect just how big these numbers get. But disputing the issue of rights versus obligations, I think you put, frankly, that issue to bed in this paper. I thought it was very well done.
Tuck?
I think I would agree asset exists, so your paper is well written. However, perhaps it would be difficult for us when it comes to the derecognition and when it comes to the impairment. So perhaps recognizing asset would be relatively easy, but how can we judge whether we should derecognize, whether how can we estimate whether it is impaired or not? That's the one observation. The other thing I just want to point out is interaction between the conceptual framework project. So now, this is kind of case study of the conceptual framework. So because of this rate-regulated project, it's quite easy to understand what the DP is talking about. So this is kind of a textbook, like how to read discussion paper. So that's fine, and it may improve the discussion paper as well. But one thing I'm afraid is, now we have the case of rate regulated. So therefore, it's a good feedback to the conceptual framework. But there might be other cases which would affect conceptual framework, but we don't know yet. So my fear is this project may distort the conceptual framework a little bit. So we have, I'm not suggesting you, just maybe suggesting Peter, we should be careful when we proceed the conceptual framework.
Mary?
I apologize, and this may be a personal problem. I'm struggling with exactly the point that Pat Finnegan thinks, you know, got put to bed in this paper, which is the analysis against the conceptual framework criteria and in wake of Ian's comments and the further discussion, looking back at table that's above paragraph 19 in the following section, I think I don't see, I'm not getting why the right to change price is an asset. And that's what I'm struggling. I have no problems with the analysis around the mechanism and the degree of assurance. I'm not quarreling with the probability implication that we have in the current the current framework, it's not any concern around that. This comes back to, I think, what do we mean by resource? So, like Tuck, I think this is a very good case study for testing some of our thinking in the discussion paper. And Jane, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot here, can you just walk me through again, because it's not clicking for me in the written paper, why the right to change price is for regulated entities a resource controlled, but is not a resource controlled for entities without regulation. That's, I think, the heart of it.
I can understand that, but I think, and it may well be that I haven't made it clear enough in the paper, I don't think it's the right to charge higher prices in the future that's the right that right I'm talking about here.
Okay.
What I'm talking about is the right, and it comes back to Gary's point, and perhaps that's what I needed to articulate more, it's the right to earn a particular amount of revenue in a period. And the best we can do is estimate how we're going to get to that amount. And the right is the fact that we can earn a certain amount. If we earn less than that amount, we have to have some sort of mechanism to make sure that we get that amount finalised. And as I tried to draw out in this paper, there are different mechanisms that the regulator can use. It could be just a cash transaction with the regulator that we've seen, albeit very rare examples, but at the end of the day, the regulator has said, we agreed that you should, or the regulation agrees that you should be able to earn 500, you've only earned 450, so here's a check for the 50, that's the balance. In some cases, the regulation, the mechanism for getting that 50 is that you send additional bills to the customers, which can happen predominantly in places where you have a small number of customers, maybe in a particular group. They could be heavy, you know, commercial users, etc. And so it's relatively easy that you can say, okay, I've got 3 customers in this group, I've got a shortfall of 50, I'll split that 50 pro rata between the usage for the previous period. But in the majority of cases, by far the vast majority of cases, the regulator goes, you've got a shortfall of 50, what's the best mechanism? Well, I could give you a check, but then I'm the government and I will just have to put, you know, taxes up to get that. And instead of doing that, what I will say is, you can recover that 50 by adding something to the bills of all of your customers or groups of customers for a particular period until you get that 50 recovered. And as Ian pointed out, if you then end up getting more than 50, you similarly just have to adjust the balance so that you go ahead.
You get less, you keep that right to make that money.
Yeah. But it's the right to achieve a particular
outcome. I think that's a very, very important articulation that didn't come through for me in a couple of readings of the paper, that the distinguishing feature that we're focusing on, you know, that you're suggesting we focus on, is the right to earn a particular amount, whether that's revenue or profit or, you know,
and a contractually enforceable right.
And that's it, because I think it's thinking back to the consultative group last week,
yeah,
it's that right to earn that may kind of separate the sheep from the goats. And, you know, as we go forward, because many people were focusing on me, why are you distinguishing if I'm rate regulated? I should, you know, it's impacting, it's important information. So without trying to do the blowout, you know, the scope of the examples we're discussing, I think it takes it away from the mechanisms, you know, and the whole analysis of dual rate adjustments, etc., to this is what we see, you know, what we are exploring, seeing as the right that meets the conceptual framework definition of an asset that would be built on. Kind of needs like blinking lights surrounding it.
Yeah, yeah. Flag it up a lot more, and the actual mechanism, I think, is more the recognition of the probability aspects of it. Yeah.
Stephen?
Do you use the phrase contractually enforceable? Is it?
No.
It's statutorily enforceable.
which is why I've avoided using the revenue recognition project directly, because there's a specific contract between the company and the consumer. This is different.
The right is statutorily enforceable.
Yeah.
But the recovery depends upon your customers buying the goods.
Yes. Yeah.
Which may or may not happen.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, but if it does not happen, you know, for this asset to be recognized, then it should remain that asset.
There is a last man standing mechanism here. Is that if you have less customers buying, they end up the fewer customers have to pay more per customer to make sure that balance is recovered ultimately.
Well,
that's the intent.
I think the regulator, the government, should have the should be forced to make up for it one way or another. It could also, you know, as mentioned, could be a subsidy, or if the customer base is too small and they don't want a huge price hike, they could find other ways to do it.
Absolutely.
But what is decisive here is that there remains this obligation by the regulator to make good.
Yeah.
Gary?
Yeah, Tom. Eugene, I'm where Pat is. I think he made a very cogent and excellent argument for it, for why it's an asset or a liability vis-a-vis, you know, linkage to both the existing as well as the potential future conceptual framework. But one thing I think might be confusing, a little bit harder to get through, when you say, so if you don't get the volume, you might have to make it up. That may or may not be the case. At some point, you take business risk too, you know, in there. So perhaps another example you could use in the paper is where they have a very different handling for something. For example, you could have pension expense on a GAAP or an IFRS basis, and they say, fine, the only thing in the rate case that you can get is your cash contribution. And that's a little bit that's a little bit easier to understand. That's what gets a cash basis pension cost on your accrual basis. I mean, you see that in government contracting elsewhere, as opposed to, well, you didn't get the volume, we got to make it up to, that may or may not be the case.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a thought for a different example.
Yeah, that's a very common example.
The pension one is the one that worries me, because that asset can run on for 30, 40 years, and it keeps growing and growing and growing. It gets huge.
And I think these things, I mean, I actually was in public accounting, and I had some clients who are in, you know, public utilities, and we spend time not helping with the rate cases to understand exactly these things, and the rollovers and the carry forwards and backs, things just go on and on. You know, when, much like, you know, income tax audits, we've got major carry back and carry forward periods. I mean, it's just a massive triangulation, you know, of tracking these things.
Just in relation to that, paragraph 72 and 73 surprised me a bit, where you sort of say most of them can, in their receivables and payables, can separate all these things out. I mean, if you're a big utilities company, you have millions of invoices going out. Do they really divide them up into, you know, the true up bit and the...
Apparently, in some cases, not necessarily the whole of the true-up adjustment, but in some cases, they can highlight on the bills to individual customers to say, you know, there's this amount for the electricity you've used during the year, and then there's this additional amount, be it positive or negative, that relates to...
But, I mean, if the regulator says, after I've added up all the things and the different things, you can charge $2.20 next year. I mean... That's just a general outcome, quite often, as I understand it. I mean, within that outcome, there'll be all sorts of calculations on your pensions and on other things that happened and the true-ups you haven't had before, you know, haven't recovered fully.
But some places it's progressive. Depending on your usage, you get different rates to be hit on you. So it's progressive. Like if you use more than certain limit, you get a higher rate.
Sure.
And because the rates are also progressive.
But I'd be surprised in those circumstances if they could break it all back to...
Sometimes they don't. It depends. Sometimes they will have a specific item. So, For example, if there has been a huge storm, a hurricane, that creates quite sometimes a big hit on the rate. And again, it's the politics quite often to say, your bill's going up by 15%, but a big chunk of that is because we had to fix the hurricane.
Well, they probably put it as a surcharge or something in the itemizing of the bill as opposed to the base fee.
And there's different groups of customers that might have to suffer the adjustment. It's not always all customers across the board. So as Gary said, the actual bookkeeping for this can get very, very complicated. But the handbooks that they have force that through.
I'd question you use the word usually. In paragraph, didn't it's in the first sentence.
Yeah, I think this is another one of those things that I'm trying to keep the case quite simple so that we can see the wood for the trees and then worry about the other cases that are not quite so usual, perhaps once we get a clearer picture as to where we're going.
Actually, airlines, telecom, and the utilities are the first ones to, even in developing countries, to adopt computerization. The only reason is detailed tracking is needed. So they are the first people to adopt, even in developing countries. So they have detailed records.
Maru?
Excellent. I think I have a comment. So I was same line as Mary expressed it. I think the paper is a very good paper. When you open and you brought up the result of last week's meeting with the group, my reading of the meeting is that the group really wants an extension of the scope of this project. And I was a little bit frightened at inception, because the extension they were envisaging, it's really bringing the project nearer to other types of businesses that have the simple, as in the continuity of the business, have the freedom to raise prices or decrease prices. So I think you brought this to our attention in a good moment. I'm still struggling, I think, as Mary, with the control concept, with two aspects of that. What is really the economic resource? So clearly there are rights, apparently rights and obligations as a result of the normal course of business. So within the discussion of the group and the discussion with particular industries in this aspect, two aspects are generally brought to my attention. One is there is economic value as a result of the actions of the regulators. And this economic value is prices by the market and prices in transactions in general. So and they understand this economic value as not being recognized in the accounts, provides a misleading information to users. The second is they see this process as an economic value that is realizable quicker than even other assets that are in the balance sheet, recognized right now in the balance sheet, like they usually mention PPE or some kinds of PPE. So they see this as realized. They feel that this will be realized soon or in the next period. So it's a sort of intangible that is quickly realizable.
Sometimes, could say.
No, their view. I'm not saying this is my view. This is their view. And that's why they wish this to be accounted as mostly assets. My sense is that after the discussion, we are apparently or more resigned to recognize liabilities, because this is our tendency of this prudent action. So we barely discuss as liabilities on the table. We are discussing mostly assets. So that said, I think, and I this is my reading of your explanation, we need to explore a little bit more two aspects in my view here. One is what is really the economic resource we are talking about, and one is what is this control by the company. Because I'm still struggling to see, I acknowledge the economic value, but I'm still struggling to see whom owns the company this right? Who has the liability to the company? It's surely not the regulator, not in the environment that I know. The regulator never book a liability to the company. So I think we should explore this in more detail here. And I have one additional question. So do you think...
That's the regulator that imposes the liability on the customer.
Yeah. But this customer can simply avoid the liability, just not turning on the light or moving from to another state, or eventually change the provider of the service.
Well, that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's important that one of the conditions is a sort of a monopoly. Position, so that the likelihood of that happening.
Yeah, but then we enter in two new camps in accounting standard setting. One is the consideration of the monopoly. One is another consideration of the unavoidability by the customer to consume that. Yeah. And I think it would be quite challenging for us to explore this in accounting standard setting. But that's what we are doing here. And so my question to you is, how are you envisaging this? Because at the end of the day, you are proposing that we indicate in the discussion paper that we do actually believe that those are assets and liabilities.
Well, the discussion paper is the board's discussion paper. I know that I'm kind of holding the pen. and I can let you know what my views are, but you don't, well... Past history is you don't usually agree with me. So, you know, the preliminary views, if any, that we put in the discussion paper will be off board.
I think Amaru's point is very well taken. And at least I think as a sort of an alternative view, should be put forward that it is true that even if we recognize this as an asset, that there is no corresponding liability on the regulator. It's just the future liability of the customer, but it is not being recognized anywhere, and it does predicate completely on the likelihood or the near certainty that the customer can be made to pay. And you, indeed, do we want to go so far in accounting to...
I'm conscious that Peter's got his card up, and I don't want to jump in a little bit too much. But to be honest, I wasn't worried about that because we have IS2 on inventories, and you know we can't control customers buying our goods, but we're quite happy sticking that on the balance sheet. So that's something that you know I know other people might worry about, but
good point.
That's how I kind of got over that one. But Peter.
Yeah, it is extremely important, I think, to try and tie down exactly what the nature of the right is that we're talking about here. So let me give my take on it. Let's focus on an example where there's a license. So they've got the ability to operate in the license. So the license will create a set of rights and obligations for the entity. And what the paper's done is it's divided them into two categories. One is it's the right to operate, and it's the right to charge up to a price that will recover your expected costs for the current period. And that, we've been quite happy in the past to deal with that in normal intangibles accounting. And then the second set of rights and obligations is to recover the sort of deficit from the past or to pay back what's been over-collected in the past. And what we're saying is that set of rights and obligations, it still arises under the license. So it's still a license type asset, for example. It's not a financial instrument. It's not a financial receivable or payable. So the regulator doesn't have an obligation to pay anything over. What they've done is they've created the rights and obligations under the license. And what we're exploring in the project is whether it's worth separating out that particular subset of the rights and obligations, recognising them differently, measuring them differently, because they have some different characteristics. And the characteristics look a bit like financial assets and liabilities because of the certainty and the monopoly and all those things, and that maybe justifies a different measurement for that subset of rights. But the actual nature of the rights is that it's still a license type right, and we've carved out a piece of that type of right. And I think it is very important in the discussion paper we try and pin down exactly what sort of rights we're talking about. And I think that's what gives the control, because what the entity does is it controls its rights under the license, but both parts, the first part which we're not focusing on so much, but also the second part which we're focusing on separately. Having gone through all this, I'm actually quite happy that there's an asset there. Sometimes I'm a bit more bothered about whether the case is made for the obligation, because I see it as part of the overall package within the license. And I think most of the time I can get there, particularly if they can be required to pay it back if they exit the market. If they're able to exit the market and hold on to it, then we get into some of those questions we discussed in the discussion paper about do they have the practical ability to exit and so on. So actually, I feel more comfortable with the asset. Slightly more question over liability sometimes.
I'm the opposite way around, but as long as we both come to the same bottom line, that's fine.
But Peter, can I challenge you? If you want to account for a type of license, a part of license, then how linked to the future cash flow? Because in the current framework, the current standard, license is not recognized based on value. But we are not talking about, you know, recognizing something based on future cash flow. So how can you type these?
Yeah, but my point is that what we're talking about there is license rights. Normally our measurement for license rights has either been what you paid for them or we don't capitalize them at all. But in this case, we're considering a different treatment because of the particular profile of cash flows that's likely to arise from it.
Yeah, this is my question.
But I think that's a measurement question rather than trying to identify what the nature of the asset is that the entity's got.
Jan?
I think Mary's question is a very good one, and your answer is very important, or our answer is very important on how we do this. And I agree with Amar, of course, that contractually enforceable is a good word to start with, and you used it. I don't think it works for me. Assume you are in a city and people start to move out, but you have a monopoly of electricity, and all of a sudden half the population has disappeared and you raise your prices, and people will start to buy diesel engines to generate electricity or whatever happens. But I don't think it works really, because you can't just charge prices on a small population. Assume now that I have a 10-year contract with an energy supplier, and it's a private, two private parties, and they agree that because of this storm you had and the problems you had, I allow you during the coming 10-year period to raise your prices. I guess that would not fit into what we're talking about, but the content of the contract would be even better than the rate regulated. I would then carry that over into a supplier who was to develop a new component for my industry. And he ran into difficulties in production or the R&D phase. And the customer is saying, oh, I see your problem, but I really trust you to be a 10-year forward supplier to me. So I allow you to offset that with a small profit margin in the future pricing. And we have an agreement whereby I'm committed to buy whatever happens. Wouldn't fit in, but I mean, I think there are examples where this definition of an asset can easily be brought into widening this very, very much if we stick to something like what you mentioned. But I think how we describe this is very, very important, not only for this, but also for how we move along seeing what is an asset. And I would be really scared if we said that we allow this asset definition to enlarge so many things that this may lead to. I think that's perhaps, for me, more important than the rate regulated issue, because we can perhaps solve that in some other way.
Mary?
Going back to your response to the question, what is the research that needs the definition of an asset in the conceptual framework, the right to earn particular amounts of revenue, etc. It's a marker for an issue that we'll come to later on in the project, which is if you recognize an asset, is it a single item or amount, or does it get spread across the recognized items in the balance sheet? So, for example, if we are concluding, you know, if we do conclude that the asset is the right to recover an amount, then why does that get split up between PP&E, you know, and other items in your balance sheet? And so I think we're going to have to connect those dots as we look at it. Just
that's definitely, because again it's we're trying to take step by step,
right.
So that's definitely on the agenda.
And I think it's a very close connection, which is why I agree with Peter's point, which is that it's very important to identify what the resource controlled by the entity is.
I picked up something from last week's rate regulated, and I thought it might be worthwhile to bring it up, is that what is the connection, if any, between this discussion and what we do in a business combination? Like, well, suppose I go and acquire Jan Engstrom utility company, and he has these rights and obligations. What do I do in that? Does that help in any way the steps we take there, or the process we go through to identify the assets and liabilities in a business combination? How does that work here, and is there anything we need to think about it? Because when one of the participants raised this issue last week, and I said, look, I've done business combinations quite a bit, and I would let them recognize an asset and a liability, and that really like struck me quite potently.
Yeah, we did have, for those that weren't involved last week, we had a short initial session last week to try and identify how people do account for business combinations in the rate regulated environment, because those that I've spoken to in the IFRS jurisdictions really struggle with these, because as PK says, it does have a real economic effect. And in pricing the business combination, people do take into account the fact that we've got these balances. And in an IFRS world, we're generally not recognising these balances in the financial statements, but we're still tracking them in our records, because we have to do that for regulatory purposes. And so if you do have a business combination, I suppose the first thing I should say is that they normally have to go through the rate regulator, because these are essential goods and services we're talking about. So you can't just exit the market. If you want to exit the market, normally you have to find somebody to take over your place in the market, especially if you're the monopoly supplier. So these things, again, these transactions normally go through the regulator, at least on an oversight basis. And in terms of pricing, the valuation that's applied does include these regulatory balances. And to PK's point, in some of those jurisdictions where they currently recognise these things under US GAAP or Canadian GAAP or whatever, they do sometimes mix these balances in with other items on the balance sheet, for example, PP&E. And the PP&E value that they do in their fair value calculations is normally the rate base that's allowed in the regulation, because the regulation only allows them to earn a particular rate of return on their infrastructure. And the common message that we got on Friday is that quite often, if the book value reflects the rate base, then that is usually deemed to approximate to the fair value, because they use the rate that's allowable by the rate regulator as their discount rate. So by the time you throw it out and discount it back, you end up with the rate base. And people feel that if you put any other figure in there, you're just getting a false mismatch. So if you're trying to use a market discount rate or whatever, that's not reflecting the fact that you have got this restriction or this guarantee, for another word, on the amount that you're allowed to earn. And so yes, in terms of a business combination, they do take these things into account, and it's reflected in the price of business combination.
Right. an important in the price of individual assets and liabilities rather than just in the
global
somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's more dangerous, right? Because they consider it whether they identify it separately or whether they identify it as a part of another asset. It is going into their thought process. It is going into their pricing decision to buy or not to buy an entity at what price. So it is part of the negotiation.
Yes. Yeah.
I find it relatively easy to be convinced by your conclusions and then in paragraph 84 as a minimum for the asset size. A bit like Peter, I would say. Now, if you have an asset, presumably someone reporting under IFRS has a liability. So a customer reporting under IFRS should book a liability, possibly to the extent that you are recognizing an asset. Why? Because it's a past event. And the question, do you apply view 1 or view 2 of the conceptual framework? If you apply view 1, IAS 37, you say no, because I can avoid. I can, as I said, I can just stop consuming electricity so that I don't pay anything. But under view 2, do you have a practical ability to stop consuming electricity? Well, you have a factory, it's running, and you need electricity to run your factory. You are going concerned. You continue to consume electricity, and under view 2, you have a liability. So I think we should link the discussion of the asset side with does someone has a liability facing that asset.
Is it liability for the whole consumption of electricity or just
not for the extra price? I think it would be for the excess price I will have to pay based on my past consumption. The electricity that I would pay absent the mechanism for my future activity is not a liability, obviously. But if I have an extra amount to pay, which is related to my past consumption, past events, and I cannot avoid to pay under view 2 in a practical way, I think I will not be uncomfortable with having a liability. Now, when I look at the liability side of the rate-regulated entity...
But also people that move into the market or factories that move into the market will have nothing to do with the past events.
It's a small proportion of the total. Unless the population is very fluid, which is usually not the case with those
consumer has nothing to do with that past event.
I think we need to include it in the discussion paper. Yes. You're absolutely right.
I think so.
I don't think you necessarily will have a liability on the customers,
depending on the rate regulation. But if it's waste
electrical products, the actual liability is relating to your future activities in that particular circumstance. Because in most mechanisms that we're talking about, the consumer doesn't have an obligation to buy that electricity in the future, but other customers do.
I think the decisive factor here is not the consumer, but the position of the regulator. Suppose you have a situation like in Detroit, the car industry implodes, the city loses half of its population, and clearly you will not be able to recover the assets without usurious energy prices. So another solution will have to be found. Then I think it should be incumbent on the regulator to find a solution, one way or another. I think that is the underlying liability.
With your respect, if I can continue, I think the regulation mechanism creates two effects, one on the rate-regulated entity, on one of the people who buy those goods or services. So if we discuss in the discussion paper only one aspect, people will ask, well, maybe you are missing the other point. Now, whether the rate regulation creates a liability when you overcharge and you have to reduce your future prices, that's more difficult, I think, because you are still recovering a certain amount of money out of your future services. You can still make profit, so what you make is less profit. Is a reduction of profit, I think that was Peter's point, a liability, that is a bit more difficult to be convinced.
It's a past event,
but I will make less profit in the future as a result of the past event. I'm not going to make
It's an equalization. You're going to make the same profit in both periods.
you're just moving it from one period to another.
If you accept the notion of a deferred profit, deferred assets, deferred that, this is not this notion of deferrals is not very well fitting in our current framework.
That's why I want to look at the revenue recognition stuff.
So it's about the same. Now, to the more difficult question of whether the system itself creates a license, creates some form of a license, it seems to me that if you are, and I know the similarity is not perfect, that if you are operating a toll bridge in a city, inside the city, linking the two banks of the river, and that is the only bridge in the city, and you have a license, a monopoly to operate this toll bridge under a concession. So obviously you have an asset, an intangible asset, or a receivable if it is guaranteed by government, and we have no problem with that. Here we have a system which is a bit similar in a way. If you have a monopoly, there is no way people are not going to use your services unless they decide to stay on both sides of the city, but in most cases that will not happen. So economically, I don't think it's quite different, and to have economically an asset arising out of this system might be okay. The question is it an asset for which you have a cost, for which you have invested money and you can have a cost basis, which is the case with concessions, or is it a self-generated intangible asset, which we normally don't recognize? That's, to me, the difficulty.
Okay, I think that brings us to the end of our discussion.
Yes, thank you very much for that. Just to let you know that the next steps, obviously we will take the conversation that we had last week with the consultative group, we'll take the conversation that we've had this morning, and then try and come back in January with a further analysis of clarification. We'll also think about the possibility of expanding out, etc., for the next steps in the development of the discussion paper. But thank you very much for your contribution this morning. It's been very, very helpful.
Was it?